Well, she certainly deserved the dismissal after burning him like that. So she turned, and maybe she looked as pathetic as she felt, because he suddenly said, "Wait. Shut the door." She obeyed. He didn't give her leave to sit, so she leaned against the wooden door and waited. He kept his back to her, and she watched the powerful muscles expand and contract as he took a deep breath. Then another. Then,
"When my mate died, it took me a very, very long time to come back."
It took her a moment to think of what to say. How long ago?
203 years, 27 days ago.
He gestured to the tattoo on his face, neck, arms.
"This tells the story of how it happened, of the shame I'll carry until my last breath."
The warrior who had come the other day had such hollow eyes. "Others come to you to have their own grief and shame tattooed on them."
"Gabriel lost 3 of his soldiers in an ambush in the southern mountains. They were slaughtered. He survived. For as long as he's been a warrior, he's tattooed himself with the names of those under his command who have fallen. But where the blame lies has little to do with the point of the markings."
"Were you to blame?" Slowly, he turned. Not quite all the way, but enough to give her a sidelong glance.
"Yes. When I was young, I was ferocious in my efforts to win valor for myself and my bloodline. Wherever Maeve sent me on campaigns, I went. Along the way, I made it a female of our race."
"Lyria," he said, almost reverently.
"She sold flowers in the market in Doranel. Maeve disapproved, but when you meet your mate, there is nothing you can do to alter it. She was mine, and no one could tell me otherwise. Mating her cost me Maeve's favor, and I still yearned so badly to prove myself. So when war came calling and Maeve offered me a chance to redeem myself, I took it. Lyria begged me not to go, but I was so arrogant, so misguided, that I left her at our mountain home and went off to war. I left her alone,"
he said, and again looked at Selena. "You left me," she had said to him. That was when he'd snapped,
the wounds of centuries ago rising up to swallow him as viciously as her own past consumed her. "I was gone for months, winning all that glory I so foolishly sought. And then we got word that our enemies had been secretly trying to gain entrance to Doranel through the mountain passes."
Her stomach dropped to her feet.
Rowan ran a hand through his hair, scratched at his face. "I flew home, as fast as I'd ever flown. When I got there, I found that found she had been with child. And they had slaughtered her anyway, and burnt our house to cinders. When you lose a mate, you don't—"
A shake of the head.
"I lost all sense of self, of time and place. I hunted them down, all the males who hurt her. I took a long while killing them. She was pregnant. Had been pregnant since I'd left her, but I'd been so enamored with my own foolish agenda that I hadn't scented it on her. I left my pregnant mate alone."
Her voice broke, but she managed to say, "What did you do after you killed them?" His face was stark, and his eyes focused on some far-off sight.
"For 10 years I did nothing. I vanished. I went mad. Beyond mad. I felt nothing at all. I just left. I wandered the world, in and out of my forms, hardly marking the seasons, eating only when my hawk told me it needed to feed or it would die. I would have let myself die, except I couldn't bring myself.
He trailed off and cleared his throat.
I might have stayed that way forever, but Maeve tracked me down. She said it was enough time spent in mourning, and that I was to serve her as prince and commander, to work with a handful of other warriors to protect the realm. It was the first time I had spoken to anyone since that day I found Lyria. The first time I'd heard my name, or remembered it.
So you went with her?
I had nothing. No one. At that point, I hoped serving her might get me killed, and then I could see Lyria again. So when I returned to Doranau, I wrote the story of my shame on my flesh, and then I bound myself to Maeve with the blood oath, and have served her since.
How did you come back from that kind of loss?
I didn't. For a long while, I couldn't. I think I'm still not back. I might never be.
She nodded, lips pressed tight, and glanced toward the window.
But maybe,
he said, quietly enough that she looked at him again. He didn't smile, but his eyes were inquisitive.
Maybe we could find the way back together.
He would not apologize for today or yesterday or for any of it, and she would not ask him to. Not now that she understood that in the weeks she had been looking at him, it had been like gazing at a reflection. No wonder she had loathed him.
I think,
she said, barely more than a whisper.
I would like that very much.
He held out a hand. Together, then.
She studied the scarred, calloused palm, then the tattooed face, full of a grim sort of hope. Someone who might, who did understand what it was like to be crippled at your very core. Someone who was still climbing inch by inch out of that abyss. Perhaps they would never get out of it. Perhaps they would never be whole again, but...
Together,
she said, and took his outstretched hand. And somewhere far and deep inside her, an ember began to glow. Part 2. Heir of Fire. Chapter 36.
Things are ready for your meeting tonight with Captain Westfall?
Adian could have sworn Ren Alsbrook bristled as he bit out the name. Seated beside the young lord on the ledge of the roof of the warehouse apartment, Adian considered Ren's tone, decided it wasn't enough of a challenge to warrant a verbal slap, and gave a nod as he went back to cleaning his nails with one of his fighting knives. Ren had been recovering for days now, after the captain had set him up in the guest room of the apartment. The old man had refused to take the main bedroom, saying he'd prefer the couch, but Adian wondered what exactly Murtaug had observed when they arrived in the apartment. If he suspected who the owner was, Selena or Aelin or both, he revealed nothing. Adian hadn't seen Ren since the opium den, and he didn't really know why he'd bothered to come tonight. He said,
You've managed to build yourself a network of lowlifes here. That's a far cry from the lofty towers of Alsbrook Castle.
Ren's jaw tightened.
You're a far cry from the White Towers of Orinth, too. We all are.
A breeze ruffled Ren's shaggy hair.
Thank you for helping that night.
It was nothing, Adian said coolly, giving him a lazy smile.
You killed for me, then hit me. That isn't nothing. I owe you.
Adian was plenty used to accepting gratitude from other men. From his men. But this...
You should have told me,
he said, dropping the grin as he watched the golden lights twinkling across the city.
That you and your grandfather had no home.
Or money. No wonder Ren's clothes were so shabby. The shame Adian had felt that night had almost overwhelmed him, and had haunted him for the past few days, honing his temper to a near-lethal edge. He'd tried working it off with the castle guards, but sparring with the men who protected the king had only sharpened it.
I don't see how it's relevant to anything,
Ren said tightly. Adian could understand pride. The kind Ren had went deep, and admitting this vulnerability was as hard for him as it was for Adian to accept Ren's gratitude. Ren said,
If you find out how to break the spell on magic, you're going to do it, right? Yes. It could make a difference in whatever battles lie ahead. It didn't make a difference 10 years ago.
Ren's face was a mask of ice. And then Adian remembered. Ren hardly had a drop of magic, but Ren's two elder sisters. The girls had been away at their mountain school when everything went to hell. A school for magic. As if reading his thoughts, as if this were a reprieve from the city below them, Ren said,
When the soldiers dragged us to the butchering blocks, that was what they mocked my parents about. Because even with their magic, my sister's school was defenseless. They could do nothing against 10,000 soldiers. I'm sorry, Adian said.
That was all he could offer for the time being, until Aelin returned. Ren looked right at him.
Going back to Terrasen will be hard for me and for my grandfather.
He seemed to struggle with the words, or just with the idea of telling anyone anything. But Adian gave him the time he needed. At last Ren said,
I'm not sure I'm civilized enough anymore. I don't know if I could be a lord, even. If my people would want me as lord. My grandfather is better suited, but he's in Alsbrook by marriage and he says he doesn't want to rule.
Ah. Adian found himself actually pausing. Contemplating. The wrong word, the wrong reaction, could make Ren shut up forever. It shouldn't matter, but it did. So he said,
My life has been war and death for the past 10 years. It will probably be war and death for the next few as well. But if there's ever a day when we find peace...
God's that word. That beautiful word.
It'll be a strange transition for all of us. For whatever it's worth, I don't see how the people of Alsbrook wouldn't embrace a lord who spent years trying to break Otterlin's rule. Or a lord who spent years in poverty for that dream.
I've done things,
Ren said.
Bad things.
Adian had suspected as much from the moment Ren gave them the address of the opium den.
So have we all, Adian said. So has Aelin.
He wanted to say it, but he still didn't want Ren or Murtaugh or anyone knowing a damn thing about her. It was her story to tell. Adian knew the conversation was about to take a turn for the ugly when Ren tensed and asked too quietly,
What do you plan to do about Captain Westfall?
Right now, Captain Westfall is useful to me, and useful to our queen.
So, as soon as he's outlived his usefulness?
I'll decide that when the time comes. If it's safe to leave him alive.
Ren opened his mouth, but Adian added,
This is the way it has to be. The way I operate.
even if he'd helped save Ren's life and given him a place to stay.
I wonder what our queen will think of the way you operate.
Adian flashed him a glare that had sent men running. But he knew Ren wasn't particularly scared of him, not with what he had seen and endured. Not after Adian had killed for him. Adian said,
If she's smart, then she'll let me do what needs to be done. She'll use me as the weapon I am.
What if she wishes to be your friend? Would you deny her that, too?
I will deny her nothing.
And if she asks you to be her king?
Adian bared his teeth.
Enough.
Do you want to be king?
Adian swung his legs back onto the roof and stood.
All I want, he snarled, is for my people to be free and my queen restored to her throne.
They burned the antler throne, Adian. There is no throne for her.
Then I'll build one myself from the bones of our enemies.
Ren winced as he stood as well, his injuries no doubt bothering him, and kept his distance. He might not be afraid, but he wasn't stupid.
Answer the question. Do you want to be king?
If she asked me, I would not refuse her.
It was the truth.
That's not an answer.
He knew why Ren had asked. Even Adian was aware that he could be king. With his legion and ties to the Ash Rivers, he'd be an advantageous match. A warrior king would make any foes think twice. Even before their kingdom shattered, he'd heard the rumors.
My only wish, Adian said, growling in Ren's face, is to see her again. Just once, if that's all the gods will allow me. If they grant me more time than that, then I'll thank them every damn day of my life. But for now, all I'm working for is to see her, to know for certain that she's real, that she survived. The rest is none of your concern.
He felt Ren's eyes on him as he vanished through the door to the apartment below. The tavern was packed with soldiers on rotation home to Otterlin, the heat and reek of bodies making Kaol wish Adian had done this alone. There was no hiding now that he and Adian were drinking friends, as the general trumpeted for everyone to hear while the soldiers cheered.
Better to hide it right under everyone's nose than pretend, eh?
Adian murmured to Kaol, as yet another free drink was slapped down on their stained, sodden table. Courtesy of a soldier who had bowed, actually bowed, to Adian.
For the wolf,
said the scarred and tan-skinned soldier, before returning to his packed table of comrades. Adian saluted the man with the mug, getting a cheer in response, and there was nothing faked about his feral grin. It hadn't taken Adian long to find the soldiers Murtaugh thought they should question. Soldiers who had been stationed at one of the suspected spell origin points. While Adian had been searching for the right group of men, Kaol had taken the time to go about his own duties, which now included considering a candidate to replace him, and packing for his return to Aniel. He'd come into Rifthold today with the excuse of finding a company to ship his first trunk of belongings, a task he'd actually accomplished. He didn't want to think of what his mother would do when the trunk of books arrived at the keep. Kaol didn't bother looking pleasant as he said,
Get on with it.
Adian stood, hoisting his mug. As though they'd all been watching him, the room quieted.
Soldiers,
he said, loud and soft at once, grave and reverent. He turned in place, mug still upheld.
For your blood, for your scars, for every dent in your shield and nick in your sword, for every friend and foe dead before you.
The mug raised higher, and Adian bowed his head, golden hair gleaming in the light.
For what you have given
and have yet to give, I salute you.
For a heartbeat, as the room thundered with roars and cries, Kaol beheld what truly made Adian a threat, what made him a god to these men, and why the king tolerated his insolence, ring or no ring. Adian was not a noble in a castle sipping wine. He was metal and sweat, sitting in this filthy tavern drinking their ale. Whether it was real or not, they believed he cared about them, listened to them. They preened when he remembered their names, their wives' and sisters' names, and slept assured that he saw them as his brothers. Adian made sure that they believed he would fight and die for them. Thus they would fight and die for him. And Kaol was afraid, but not for himself. He was afraid of what would come when Adian and Aelin were reunited. For he'd seen in her that same glittering ember that made people look and listen. Had seen her stalk into a council meeting with Counselor Mollison's head and smile at the King of Otterlin. Every man in that room enthralled and petrified by the dark whirlwind of her spirit. The two of them together, both of them lethal, working hard to build an army, to ignite their people. He was afraid of what they would do to his kingdom. Because this was still his kingdom. He was working for Dorian, not Aelin, not Adian. And he didn't know where all of this put him.
A contest! Adian called, standing on the bench.
Kaol hadn't moved during the long, long hour Adian had been saluted and toasted by half the men in this room, each one getting a turn to stand and tell his story to the general. When Adian had enough of being serenaded by his own enemy, his Ash River eyes brilliant with a rush that Kaol knew was precisely because he hated each and every one of them, and they were eating out of his palm like rabbits, the general roared for the contest. There were a few shouted suggestions for drinking games, but Adian hoisted his mug again, and silence fell.
Farthest to travel drinks for free.
There were cries of Benjali, Orinth, Melisande, Aniel, and Dovier, but then...
Quiet, all of you.
An older gray-haired soldier stood.
I got you all beat.
He lifted his glass to the general and pulled a scroll from his vest. Release papers.
I just spent 5 years at Knoll.
Bullseye. Adian thumped the empty seat at the table.
Then you drink with us, my friend.
The room cheered again. Knoll. It was a speck on the map at the farthest end of the deserted peninsula. The man sat down, and before Adian could raise a finger to the barkeep, a fresh pint was before the stranger.
Knoll, eh? Adian said. Commander Jensen of the 24th Legion, sir. How many men were under you, Commander? 2,000, all of us sent back here last month.
Jensen took a long drink.
5 years, and we're done just like that.
He snapped his scarred, thick fingers.
I take it His Majesty didn't give you any warning. With all due respect, General, he didn't tell us shit. I got the word that we were to move out because new forces were coming in, and we weren't needed anymore.
Kaol kept his mouth shut, listening, as Adian had told him to do.
What for? Is he sending you to join another legion? No word yet. Didn't even tell us who was taking our place.
Adian grinned.
At least you're not in Knoll anymore.
Jensen looked into his drink, but not before Kaol caught the shadow in the man's eyes.
What was it like? Off the record, of course.
Adian said. Jensen's smile had faded, and when he looked up, there was no light in his eyes.
The volcanoes are active, So it's always dark, you see, because the ash covers everything. And because of the fumes, we always had headaches. Sometimes men went mad from them. Sometimes we got nosebleeds from them, too. We got our food once a month. Occasionally less than that, depending on the season and when the ships could bring in supplies. The locals wouldn't make the trek across the sands, no matter how much we threatened and bribed them.
Why? Laziness?
No, didn't much. Just the tower in town we built around it. But the volcanoes were sacred. And 10 years ago, maybe a bit longer, apparently we... Not my men, because I wasn't there. But rumor says the king took a legion into those volcanoes and sacked the temple.
Jensen shook his head.
The locals spit on us. Even the men who weren't there for that. The tower and knoll was built afterward, and then the locals cursed it, too. So it was always just us.
A tower?
Kaol said quietly, and Adian frowned at him. Jensen drank deeply.
Not that we were ever allowed in.
The men who went mad, Adian said, a half smile on his face.
What did they do, exactly?
The shadows were back, and Jensen glanced around him. Not to see who was listening, but almost as if he wanted to find a way out of this conversation. But then he looked at the general and said,
"Our reports say, General, that we killed him. Arrows to the throat, quick and clean. But..."
Adian leaned closer.
"Not a word leaves this table."
A vague nod.
"The truth was, by the time we got our archers ready, the men who went mad had already bashed their own skulls in. Every time. As if they couldn't get the pain out."
Selena claimed Caltaine and Roland had complained about headaches, as a result of the king's magic being used on them, his horrible power. And she had told him she got a pounding headache when she uncovered those secret dungeons beneath the castle. Dungeons that led to...
"The tower. You were never allowed in?"
Kaol ignored Adian's warning glare.
"There was no door. Always seemed more decorative than anything. But I hated it. We all did. It was just this awful black stone."
"Just like the clock tower in the glass castle. Built around the same time, if not a few years before."
"Why bother?" Adian drawled. "A waste of resources, if you ask me."
There were still so many shadows in the man's eyes, full of stories that Kaol didn't dare ask about. The commander drained his glass and stood.
"I don't know why they bothered. With Knoll or Amaroth. We'd sometimes send men up and down the Western Sea with messages between the towers, so we knew they had a similar one. We didn't even really know what the hell we were all doing out there anyway. There was no one to fight."
Amaroth. The other outpost. And Murtaugh's other possible origin point for their spell. Due north from Knoll. Both the same distance from Rifthold. 3 towers of black stone, all 3 points making an equilateral triangle. It had to be part of the spell, then. Kaol traced the rim of his glass. He had sworn to keep Dorian out of it, to leave him alone. He had no way of testing out any theory, and didn't want to get within 10 feet of that clock tower. But perhaps the theory could be tested on a small scale, just to see if they were right about what the king had done. Which meant he needed Dorian. Chapter 37. It was 2 weeks of training for Manon and her 13. 2 weeks of waking up before the sun to fly each canyon run, to master it as one unit. 2 weeks of scratches and sprained limbs, of near deaths from falls or the wyverns squabbling or just stupid miscalculation. But slowly, they developed instincts. Not just fighting as a unit, but as individual riders and mounts. Manon didn't like the thought of the mounts eating the foul-tasting meat raised within the mountain. So twice a day they hunted the mountain goats, swooping to pluck them off the mountainsides. It wasn't long before the witches started eating the goats themselves, building hasty fires in the mountain passes to cook their breakfast and evening meals. Manon didn't want any of them, mounts or riders, taking another bite of the food given to them by the king's men, or tasting the men themselves. If it smelled and tasted strange, odds were something was wrong with it. She didn't know if it was the fresh meat or the extra lessons, but the 13 were starting to outpace every coven, to the point where Manon ordered the 13 to hold back whenever the yellow legs gathered to watch their lessons. Abraxos was still a problem. She hadn't dared take the crossing with him, as his wings, while slightly stronger, weren't better by much. At least not enough to brave the sheer plunge through the narrow pass. Manon had been chewing it over every night when the 13 gathered in her room to compare notes about flying, their iron nails glinting as they used their hands to demonstrate the ways they'd taught their wyverns to bank, to take off, to do some fancy maneuver. For all the excitement, they were exhausted. Even the lofty-headed bluebloods had their tempers on tight leashes, and Manon had been called in a dozen times now to break apart brawls. Manon used her downtime to see Abraxos, to check on his iron claws and teeth, to take him out for extra rides when everyone else had passed out in their cots. He needed as much training as he could get, and she liked the quiet and stillness of the night, with the silvered mountain peaks and the river of stars above, even if it made waking up the next day difficult. So after braving the wrath of her grandmother, Manon won 2 days off for the Blackbeaks, convincing her that if they didn't rest, there would be outright war in the middle of the mess hall, and the king wouldn't have an aerial cavalry left to ride his wyverns into battle. They got 2 days to sleep and eat, and to see whatever needs only the men across the mountain could provide. That was something a good number of the 13 were doing, as she'd seen Vesta, Lynn, Asterin, and the demon twins stalking across the bridge. No sleeping for Manon today or tomorrow. No eating. Or bedding men. No. She was taking Abraxos out into the ruins. He was already saddled, and Manon ensured Windcleaver was tightly strapped to her back as she mounted him. The saddlebags were an unexpected weight behind her, and she made a note to start training the 13 and the rest of the covens with them. If they were to be an army, then they'd carry their supplies, as most soldiers did. And training with weights would make them faster when it came time to fly without them.
"You sure I can't convince you not to go?"
the overseer said, as she paused at the back gates.
"You know the stories as well as I do. This won't come without a cost."
"His wings are weak, and so far everything else we've tried to reinforce them has failed," she said. "It might be the only material that could patch up his wings and withstand the winds. As I don't see any markets nearby, I suppose I'll have to go directly to the source." The overseer frowned at the gray sky beyond.
"Bad day for flying. Storm's coming."
"It's the only day I have." Even as she said it, she wished that she could take the 13 into the skies when the storm hit, to train them in that, too.
"Be careful, and think through any bargain they offer you."
"If I wanted your advice, I'd ask for it, mortal," she said. But he was right. Still, Manon led Abraxos out through the gates into their usual takeoff spot. They had a long way to fly today and tomorrow, all the way to the edge of the Rune Mountains, to find spider silk. and the legendary Stygian spiders, large as horses and deadlier than poison, who wove it. The storm hit right as Manon and Abraxos circled the westernmost outcropping of the runes. Through the icy rain lashing her face and soaking right through her layers of clothing, she could see that the mist hung low over the mountains, veiling much of the ash-gray, jagged labyrinth below. With the rising winds and lightning thrashing around them, Manon grounded Abraxos on the only open bit of land she could spot. She'd wait until the storm had passed, and then they would take to the skies and scan the area until they found the spiders, or at least clues about their whereabouts, mostly in the form of bones, she expected. But the storm continued, and though she and Abraxos pressed themselves into the side of a little cliff, it did nothing to shield them. She would have preferred snow over this freezing rain, which came with so much wind that she couldn't light a fire. Night fell swiftly thanks to the storm, and Manon had to put her iron teeth away to keep them from chattering right through her lip. Her hood was useless, soaked and dripping in her eyes, and even Abraxos had curled into as tight a ball as he could against the storm. Stupid, horrible idea. She pulled a goat leg from a saddlebag and tossed it to Abraxos, who uncurled himself long enough to chomp it down, and then went right back to shielding himself against the storm. She cursed herself for a fool as she choked down her own meal of soggy bread and a freezing apple, then gnawed on a bit of cheese. It was worth it, to secure victory for the 13, to be wing leader. One night in a storm was nothing. She'd been through worse, trapped in snowy mountain passes with fewer layers of clothes, no way out and no food. She'd survived storms some witches didn't awaken from the next morning. But she still would have preferred snow. Manon studied the labyrinth of rock around them. She could feel eyes out there, observing. Yet nothing came closer. Nothing dared. So after a while, she curled on her side, just like Abraxos, her head and chest angled toward the cliff face, and tucked her arms across herself, holding tight. Mercifully, it stopped raining in the night, or at least the angle of the wind shifted to stop pounding on them. She slept better after that, but she still shook from cold, though it felt slightly warmer. The small hints of warmth and dryness were probably what kept her from shaking to death or getting ill, she realized, as she dozed off, awakening at the gray light of dawn. When she opened her eyes, she was in shadow. Shadow, but dry and warm, thanks to the massive wing shielding her from the elements, and the heat of Abraxos's breath filling the space like a little furnace. He was still snoozing. A deep, heavy sleep. She had to brush ice crystals off his outstretched wing before he came awake. The storm had cleared, and the skies were an untamed blue, clear enough that they only needed to circle the western outcropping of the runes once before Manon spotted what she'd been looking for. Not just bones, but trees shrouded in dusty gray webs like mourning widows. It wasn't spider silk, she saw as Abraxos swooped low, gliding over the trees. These were only ordinary webs. If you could call an entire mountain wood shrouded in webs ordinary. Abraxos growled every so often at something below, shadows or whispers she couldn't see. But she did notice the crawling on the branches, spiders of every shape and size, as if they had all been summoned here to live under the protection of their massive brethren. It took them half the morning to find the ashen mountain caves hovering above the veiled wood, where bare bones littered the ground. She circled a few times, then set Abraxos down on an outcropping of stone at one of the cave mouths, the cliff face behind them a sheer plunge to a dried-out ravine below. Abraxos paced like a mountain cat, tail lashing this way and that as he watched the cave. She pointed to the edge of the cliff.
Enough. Sit down and stop moving.
You know why we're here, so don't ruin it. He huffed but plopped down, shooting grayish dust into the air. He draped his long tail along the length of the cliff's edge, a physical barrier between Manon and the plunge. Manon stared him down for a moment, before an otherworldly feminine laugh flittered from the cave mouth.
Now that beast is one we have not seen for an age.
Manon kept her face blank. The light was bright enough to reveal several ancient, merciless eyes looming within the cave mouth, and three massive shadows lurking behind. The voice said, "Closer now," pincers clicking like an accompanying drum.
"And it has been an age since we dealt with the iron teeth."
Manon didn't dare touch Windcleaver as she said, "The world is changing, sister."
"Sister?" the spider mused. "I suppose we are sisters, you and I. Two faces of the same dark coin, from the same dark maker. Sisters in spirit, if not in flesh."
Then she emerged into the murky light, the mist sweeping past her like a pilgrimage of phantom souls. She was black and gray, and the sheer mass of her was enough to make Manon's mouth go dry. Despite the size, she was elegantly built, her legs long and smooth, her body streamlined and gleaming.
Glorious.
Abraxos let out a soft growl, but Manon held out a hand to silence him.
"I see now," Manon said softly, "why my blue blood sisters still worship you."
"Do they now?"
The spider remained motionless, but the three behind her crept closer, silent and observing with their many dark eyes.
"We can hardly recall the last time the blue blood priestesses brought their sacrifices to our foothills. We do miss them."
Manon smiled tightly.
"I can think of a few I'd like to send your way."
A soft, wicked laugh.
"A blackbeak, no doubt."
Those eight massive eyes took her in, swallowed her whole.
"Your hair reminds me of our silk."
"I suppose I should be flattered."
"Tell me your name, Blackbeak."
"My name does not matter,"
Manon said. "I've come to bargain."
"What would a Blackbeak witch want with our precious silk?"
She turned to reveal the vigilant Abraxos, his focus pinned on the massive spider, tense from the tip of his nose to his iron-spiked tail.
"His wings need reinforcement. I heard the legends and wondered if your silk might help."
"We have bartered our silk to merchants and thieves and kings, to be spun into dresses and veils and sails, but never for wings."
"I'll need 10 yards of it. Woven bolts, if you have them."
The spider seemed to still further.
"Men have sacrificed their lives for a yard."
"Name your price."
10 yards.
She turned to the three waiting behind her, offspring or minions or guards, Manon didn't know.
"Bring out the bolt. I shall inspect it before I name my price."
Good. This was going well. Silence fell as the three scuttled into the cave, and Manon tried not to kick any of the tiny spiders crawling across her boots, or look for the eyes she felt watching from the nearby caves across the ravine.
"Tell me, Blackbeak," the spider said, "how did you come across your mount?"
"He was a gift from the King of Otterlin. We are to be part of his host, and when we are done serving him, we will take them home, to the wastes, to reclaim our kingdom."
"Ah. And is the curse broken?"
"Not yet, but when we find the Kraken who can undo it.
She would enjoy that bloodletting.
Such a delightfully nasty curse. You won the land, only for the cunning Krakens to curse it beyond use. Have you seen the wastes these days?
No, Manon said. I have not yet been to our home.
A merchant came by a few years ago. He told me there was a mortal high king who had set himself up there. But I heard a whisper on the wind recently that said he'd been deposed by a young woman with wine-red hair, who now calls herself their High Queen.
Manon bristled. High Queen of the Wastes, indeed. She would be the first Manon would kill when she returned to reclaim the land, when she finally saw it with her own eyes, breathed it in smells, and beheld its untamable beauty.
A strange place, the Wastes,
the spider continued. The merchant himself was from there,
a former shapeshifter. Lost his gifts, just like all of you truly mortal things. He was stuck in a man's body, thankfully, but he did not realize that when he sold me 20 years of his life, some of his gifts passed to me. I can't use them, of course, but I wonder. I do wonder what it would be like to see the world through your pretty eyes, to touch a human man.
The hair on Manon's neck rose.
Here we are,
the spider said, as the three approached, a bolt of silk flowing between them like a river of light and color. Manon's breath caught.
Isn't it magnificent? Some of the finest weaving I've ever done.
Glorious, Manon admitted. Your price?
The spider stared at her for a long time.
What price could I ask of a long-lived witch?
20 years of your lifespan is nothing to you,
even with magic aging you like an ordinary woman. And your dreams. What dark, horrible dreams they must be, Blackbeak. I do not think I should like to eat them. Not those dreams.
The spider came closer.
But what of your face? What if I took your beauty?
I do not think I'd walk away if you took my face.
The spider laughed.
Oh, I don't mean your literal face, but the color of your skin, the hue of your burnt gold eyes, the way your hair catches the light like moonlight on snow. Those things I could take. That beauty could win you a king. Perhaps if magic returns, I'll use it for my woman's body. Perhaps I'll win a king of my very own.
Manon didn't particularly care about her beauty, weapon though it was. But she wasn't about to say that, or to offer it without bargaining. I'd like to inspect the silk first.
Cut a swatch,
the spider ordered the three, who gently set down the yards of silk while one sliced off a perfect square. Men had killed for smaller amounts, and here they were, cutting it as if it were ordinary wool. Manon tried not to think about the size of the pincer that extended it to her. She stalked to the cliff edge, stepping over Abraxos's tail as she held the silk to the light.
Darkness embrace her, it sparkled.
She tugged it, flexible but strong as steel, impossibly light, but... There's an imperfection here. Can I expect the rest of it to be similarly marred? The spider hissed, and the ground thudded as she neared. Abraxos stopped her with a warning growl that set the other three coming up behind her. Guards, then. But Manon held up the swatch to the light.
Look,
Manon said, pointing to a vein of color running through it.
That's no imperfection,
the spider snapped. Abraxos's tail curled around Manon, a shield between her and the spiders, bringing her closer to the wall of his body. Manon held it higher, angling it toward the sun. Look in the better light. You think I'm going to give away my beauty for second-rate weaving?
Second-rate!
The spider seethed. Abraxos's tail curled tighter. No, it appears I'm mistaken. Manon lowered her arms, smiling. It seems I'm not in the bargaining mood today. The spiders, now standing along the cliff's edge, didn't even have time to move as Abraxos's tail unwound like a whip and slammed into them. They went flying into the ravine, shrieking. Manon didn't waste a second as she stuffed the remaining yards of silk into the empty saddlebags. She mounted Abraxos, and they leapt into the air, the cliff the perfect takeoff spot, just as she'd planned. The perfect trap for those foolish ancient monsters. Chapter 38. Manon gave a foot of spider silk to the overseer after he carefully grafted it onto Abraxos's wings. She'd gotten extra, lots of it, in case it ever wore down, and it was now locked in the false bottom of a trunk. She told no one where she had been, or why Abraxos's wings now shimmered in a certain light. Astarin would have murdered her for the risk, and her grandmother would have butchered Astarin for not being there. Manon was in no mood to replace her second and find a new member for the 13. Once Abraxos had healed, Manon brought him to the mouth of the Northern Fang to try the crossing. Before, his wings had been too weak to attempt the plunge, but with the silk reinforcements, he'd stand a far greater chance. But the risk remained, which was why Astarin and Sorrel waited behind her, already on their mounts. If things went wrong, if Abraxos couldn't pull up or the silk failed, she was to jump away from him. Let him die, while one of them caught her in the claws of their wyverns. Manon wasn't too keen on that plan, but it was the only way Astarin and Sorrel would agree to let her do it. Though Manon was the Blackbeak heir, they would have locked her in a wyvern pen rather than let her make the crossing without the proper precautions. She might have called them soft-hearted and given them the beatings they deserved. But it was smart. Tensions were worse than ever, and she wouldn't put it past the Yellowlegs' heir to spook Abraxos during the crossing. Manon nodded her readiness to her second and third before approaching her beast. Not many had gathered, but Iskra was on the viewing platform, smiling faintly. Manon checked the stirrups, the saddle, and the reins one more time. Abraxos tense and snarling. "Let's go," she said to him, pulling the reins to lead him a bit farther ahead so she could mount him. He still had plenty of space to get a running start, and with his new wings she knew he would be fine. They'd done steep plunges and hard upswings before. But Abraxos wouldn't move. "Now," she snapped at him, tugging hard. Abraxos turned an eye to her and growled. She lightly smacked his leathery cheek. "Now." Those hind legs dug in, and he tucked his wings in tight. "Abraxos." He was looking at the crossing, then back at her. Wide-eyed. Petrified. Utterly petrified. "Useless, stupid, cowardly beast." "Stop it," she said, moving to climb into the saddle instead. "Your wings are fine now." She reached for his haunch, but he reared away, the ground shaking as he slammed down. Behind her, Astarin and Sorrel murmured to their mounts, who had skittered back and snapped at Abraxos and at each other. There was a soft laugh from the viewing platform, and Manon's teeth popped down. "Abraxos, now." She reached for the saddle again. He bucked away, slamming into the wall and shrinking back. One of the men brought out a whip, but she held out a hand.
"Don't take another step," she snapped.
Iron nails out. Whips only made Abraxos more uncomfortable. She turned to her mount.
"You rutting coward,"
she hissed at the beast, pointing to the crossing.
"Get back in line."
Abraxos met her stare, refusing to back down.
"Get in line, Abraxos."
"He can't understand you,"
Asterin said quietly.
"Yes, he..."
Manon shut her mouth. She hadn't told them that theory. Not yet. She turned back to the wyvern.
"If you don't let me into that saddle and make that jump, I'm going to have you confined to the darkest, smallest pit in this bloody mountain."
He bared his teeth. She bared hers. The staring contest lasted for a full minute. One humiliating, enraging minute.
"Fine," she spat, turning from the beast. "He was a waste of her time. Have him locked up wherever he'll be the most miserable," she said to the overseer. "He's not coming out until he's willing to make the crossing."
The overseer gaped, and Manon snapped her fingers at Asterin and Sorrel to signal them to dismount. She'd never hear the end of this. Not from her grandmother, or from the Yellowlegs witches, or from Iskra, who was already making her way across the floor of the pit.
"Why don't you stay, Manon?"
Iskra called.
"I could show your wyvern how it's done."
"Keep walking,"
Sorrel murmured to Manon, but she didn't need a reminder.
"They say it's not the beasts who are the problem, but the riders,"
Iskra went on, loud enough for everyone to hear. Manon didn't turn. She didn't want to see them take Abraxos back to the gate, to whatever hole they'd lock him in. Stupid, useless beast.
"Though," Iskra said thoughtfully, "perhaps your mount needs a bit of discipline."
"Let's go," Sorrel coaxed, pressing in tight to Manon's side. Asterin walked a step behind, guarding Manon's back.
"Give that to me,"
Iskra barked at someone.
"He just needs the right encouragement."
A whip snapped behind them, and there was a roar of pain and fear. Manon stopped dead. Abraxos was huddling against the wall. Iskra stood before him, whip bloody from the line she'd sliced down his face, narrowly missing his eye. Her iron teeth shining bright, Iskra smiled at Manon as she raised the whip again and struck. Abraxos yelped. Asterin and Sorrel weren't fast enough to stop Manon as she hurtled past and tackled Iskra. Teeth and nails out, they rolled across the dirt floor, flipping and shredding and biting. Manon thought she might be roaring so loud the hall shook. Feet slammed into her stomach, and the air shot out of her as Iskra kicked her off. Manon hit the earth, spat out a mouthful of blue blood, and was up in a heartbeat. The Yellowleg's air slashed with an iron-tipped hand, a blow that could have severed through bone and flesh. Manon ducked past her guard and threw Iskra onto the unforgiving stone. Iskra groaned above the shouts of the swarming witches, and Manon brought her fist down onto her face. Her knuckles howled in pain, but all she could see was that whip, the pain in Abraxos's eyes, the fear. Struggling against Manon's weight, Iskra swiped at her face. Manon reeled back, the blow cutting down her neck. She didn't quite feel the stinging or the warm trickle of blood. She just drew back her fist, knee digging harder into Iskra's chest, and struck. Again and again. She lifted her aching fist once more, but there were hands at her wrist, under her arms, hauling her off. Manon thrashed against them, still screaming, the sound wordless and endless.
"Manon!"
Sorrel roared in her ear, and nails cut into her shoulder, not hard enough to damage, but to make her pause. to realize there were witches everywhere. In the pit and in the viewing platform, gaping.